on that street and on like midnight. You are listening to WIOX Roxbury Community Radio 91.3 FM and WIOXradio.org.
WIOX is supported by Frank Lumia Real Estate Plus. With more than 30 years sharing the four-season beauty of the Catskill Mountains, bringing buyers and sellers together, providing customized updates on land, home, and commercial properties with offices in Margaretville and Delhi. Frank Lumia Real Estate Plus. There's magic in our mountains. 607-746-6029 or franklumiarealestate.com. WIOX is supported by the Delaware County Chamber of Commerce, a catalyst for sustainable economic prosperity in the Catskills, fostering cooperation, forging partnerships, promoting tourism, providing legislative advocacy, and building strong community ties throughout the region. More information at 607-746-2281 or delawarecounty.org.
This is Tom Wadsworth, host of Real Irish on WIOX, inviting you to celebrate Roxbury with me and everyone else on Saturday, July 6th at the Celebrate Roxbury Summer Festival. I'll be broadcasting live from the porch at Kirkside, starting at 10 a.m. with a play-by-play of the parade and all the Irish music you've come to love and fear. So drop by to say hi or just tune in to my special edition of Real Irish, live at the Celebrate Roxbury Summer Festival, Saturday morning, July 6th, starting at 10.
You're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John's out tonight, so it'll be just me. And today's topic is spotted lanternfly with Penn State Extension's Heather Leach. Heather, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, I can hear you just fine. How you been?
Great. How about you?
I'm okay. So where are you calling from, Heather?
Well, I'm actually in the middle of the woods right now.
Are you kidding me? What are you doing? No. What are you doing out there?
Well, working on some experiments we've got running with a spotted lanternfly.
All right, that's cool. So, I'll introduce you real quick. But so, Heather, you're calling from Penn State Extension, is that it?
Yeah, I'm in the Department of Entomology, so the folks who study bugs.
Okay, and how did you end up doing this?
That's a good question. You know, I started out as a kid who's one of those kind of freak science kids who always likes bugs and likes looking in the water and looking at plants for all sorts of natural things. And as my career developed, I just started to get more and more interested in insects, and in particular invasive insects, you know, ones that come here and don't necessarily belong here, and they tend to cause a lot of problems. And so I became really interested in kind of that biology, the science behind that, and then ultimately how we can better preserve our ecosystems, preserve our agriculture to prevent damage from these insects.
And what's your educational background that led you to spotted lanternfly?
Yeah, so I'm a native to Michigan, and so I went to Michigan State University for both of my degrees, a bachelor's and master's. So my bachelor's was in fisheries and wildlife, and then my master's was in entomology. And for my graduate program, I studied another invasive pest called spotted wing Drosophila. This is an invasive fruit fly that comes from Asia, and it is a really big problem for berry crop growers. And so from that, I really enjoyed working with growers, and that's kind of led me to where I am now.
Does that attack apple trees?
The spotted wing Drosophila doesn't, luckily. The brown marmorated stink bug, which is another one that I worked on, does. So there's all sorts of ones. You name the crop, and you'll find an invasive that attacks it in some way.
Yeah, sure. And then after that, you were at Michigan Horticultural Research Station for extension
yeah,
there.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was my first real extension experience. And so that was, you know, really working on grower fields, communicating with them on a regular basis and trying to understand what their needs were, what they were concerned with, and then how we can address that, especially, you know, from that insect perspective.
Nice. And where in Pennsylvania exactly are you? I don't even know where you're calling from, PA. It's a big state.
Yeah, it is a big state. So I am based on main campus in University Park, so that's where I get to do all of my office work. And then because spotted lanternfly right now is in southeastern Pennsylvania, that's where I'm at right now, in the middle of the woods, and close to Reading, Pennsylvania, which is, again, in Berks County.
So you're really in the woods. You're not just lying to us.
Yeah, yep, I'm really in the woods. Luckily, I have service here, so that worked out well.
All right, that's good. Well, it is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic. And if you're just tuning in, we are talking about the spotted lanternfly with Penn State Extension's Heather Leach. So, you know, we're dealing with the emerald ash borer here. I don't know if you guys are as well. It's pretty mm-hmm. bad in New York State, especially in the Hudson River Valley and the Catskill Mountains where we are. Spotted lanternfly is right on our doorstep, so I figured we'd talk about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So emerald ash borer is another one, and obviously I bet a lot of the listeners are very familiar with this one. And really throughout the Northeast, we're seeing it, you know, really decimate ash trees. And so a lot of people I talk to, when you go out there and you say there's another invasive species, it's also attacking trees, people just, you know, they're exhausted from this and they're tired of seeing dead trees. But this is another one we are indeed worried about for forest systems.
No kidding. So what's the background on this thing? I mean, what's its Latin name, and where did it come from, and how did it get here, whatnot?
Yeah, sure. So spotted lanternfly is the common name, and it's kind of misleading. So it doesn't glow, it has no lantern capabilities, and it's not technically a fly, like one you see buzzing around your house. It's actually a plant hopper, so it's kind of closely related to things like cicadas, stink bugs, leaf hoppers fairly closely. But generally speaking, it's a really, really understudied group. So its scientific name is Lycorma delicatula, and it belongs into the insect family Fulgoridae. Now, again, very, very understudied group. And so insect hobbyists and people who just love bugs and entomologists will tend to travel to the tropics and collect trophy specimens, you know, those really colorful, really large insects. And this is a group that you can do that with, and that's what it's best known for. So spotted lanternfly's closest, related siblings, cousins, are actually very large, very, very colorful tropical species. And so people will go to collect these in their trophies. So again, we don't really think about this group as a pest species. It's primarily considered, you know, something that's beautiful, and we don't know very much about its biology or behavior because of that.
It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous insect. It really is.
It really is, you know, and it's one of the most striking insects I've ever seen, especially because, you know, it has several different life stages as it goes through here in Pennsylvania. The nymph kind of early stage before it's able to fly, and then the adult, and all of them look fairly unique, but equally striking. So they have very, you know, interesting behavior, and so it's been interesting to watch them. But if we back up a little bit, so spotted lanternfly is native to Asia, certain parts of Asia, and in particular, we're mostly talking about regions of China. And so it's not a problem in China because it's a native insect. It has, you know, predators. It has natural enemies that can kind of keep their populations in check. What's interesting is, you know, when we deal with any invasive species, when they come to a new region, they don't bring those natural enemies with them, and so their populations are able to explode. And so that's what actually happened in 2004 when spotted lanternfly, you know, just took a short trip over to Korea, and it really took off and was an invasive species there and was really problematic for Korea in managing this, especially in their agricultural crops.
No kidding. Have you spoken or discussed the spotted lanternfly with anyone from across the way?
Yeah. We have several scientist collaborators that we work with that are in Korea and also in China who have done some preliminary research on spotted lanternfly, and that's really helped us get a better sense of what to expect here in the United States. So spotted lanternfly was first detected in Pennsylvania in just one really small area of southeastern Pennsylvania in 2014. Now, based on its population level and kind of the number of egg masses that we were seeing being, you know, laid out there, we think it was actually probably introduced maybe 1 or 2 years before that, and nobody noticed it until, you know, it was able to kind of build up populations and establish a little bit. And then people started, you know, pointing at that, saying, "What is that bug? I've never seen that bug here." And so again, that's kind of the story of how it got here. And we think it arrived as an egg mass. So they go through one generation per year, and the adults lay their eggs in the fall. And those eggs are what overwinter. They survive the winter. So what we believe is that these eggs were laid on a pallet or maybe landscaping stone. And then they were shipped over to the U.S., and in particular to Pennsylvania. And then, you know, they had a happy, nice home here in the spring. They hatched out, and they've really flourished ever since.
Yeah. Now, did you say it was first found in PA, or was there another state before?
Nope, it was first found in Pennsylvania.
All right. How about that, huh? Got to be first for something.
I know. Yeah, you know, this is kind of a hub of invasive species I'm finding, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, it seems like New York State's always bringing in the stuff. So it's nice, you know, once in a while not to be the port of New York.
Yeah, we'll share the weight for you. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. All right. Yeah, so, you know, is there a quarantine area in PA?
There is. So currently we have 14 counties that are under quarantine. And if you do a little bit of research on your own with spotted lanternfly, that map will come up pretty quickly of where it is. And you'll really see that it's the southeastern chunk of Pennsylvania that's under a state-level quarantine. Now, spotted lanternfly has also spread to some of the surrounding states, so it's not, you know, it doesn't really respect state boundaries. And it's also in New Jersey and Delaware and Virginia. And so all of those states also have state-level quarantines to keep this insect from moving out of these areas, basically.
And who's administering that? Is that APHIS or is that the state?
It's all the State Department of Agriculture, yep.
Okay, all right. And that's, what is that, animal, plant, health, inspection? What's APHIS stand for again?
Yeah, with APHIS, with USDA APHIS, yeah, Inspection Service.
Okay, there we go. Thanks.
Yeah, you got pretty close, yeah.
Yeah, I was getting there. So life cycle and ID, you kind of went through it a little bit already, but this is considered still a nuisance pest. Is it? Do you think it's or is it considered more than that? What do you think in your opinion? Because you know, I spoke to some arborists and they just think it's the worst thing ever. But then when I researched it, you know, people are still calling it a nuisance pest. What do you think?
Yeah, so it's a tricky question, and it comes with a lot of caveats. So my answer will be complicated. But basically, you know, if we back up a little bit and talk about how spotted lanternfly is feeding and how it's even doing its damage, I mentioned earlier that it feeds like, you know, it's related to things like cicadas and stink bugs. So what that means is it's a hemipteran insect, and it has a piercing, sucking mouth part. So it's kind of, you know, think like a mosquito, only instead of humans, it's attacking plants. And so it's sticking its mouth parts in these plants, kind of like a mosquito. It has a nice beak that it goes in, and it feeds on those phloem cells, or basically that plant sap. So as they're starting to feed, they kind of stick their mouth inside and feed out and get out that nice, juicy plant sap. And so when we see spotted lanternfly feeding, it kind of depends on what plant you're talking about in terms of how much damage it's capable of causing. In the grape industry, in particular, we're seeing some really, really significant damage there where we end up with either vines that don't fruit or vines that completely die the following spring after, you know, they just can't survive the winter. So that we see a lot of damage with, and spotted lanternfly, you know, grapes tend to be one of their preferred hosts, so one of the hosts at the top. If we talk about forestry species, again, it really depends. They will feed on practically anything in the landscape. They'll really feed on anything except for conifers, but they will take their pick. And if they have the choice in the landscape, they'll prefer to feed on things like silver maple, red maple, black walnut, species like that, and certainly tree of heaven, which is an invasive tree as well.
No kidding. And it excretes a honeydew. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, it's not pleasant. So again, as they're feeding, they're basically seeking out carbohydrates and nitrogen that are in that plant sap. But you know, for those of people who are familiar with, you know, making maple syrup and things like that, we know that plant sap is rich in a lot of sugars. Spotted lanternfly aren't really looking for that, and so they end up with all of this excess water and sugar, basically. And so that's what they excrete constantly. So they're, you know, ingesting plant sap, taking out the good stuff that they want, and then excreting that basically kind of sugary water substance. And we like to call that honeydew. It sounds very delicate and nice, you know, like the melon. But in fact, it's insect poop, really, is the glamorous word for that. And when you get so many feeding, and when I say so many, I mean hundreds, if not thousands, of spotted lanternfly that can be up in the tree above you feeding on the canopy up top, especially in this current stage, they're in the nymphs, and they tend to be at the top of the canopy. So you can stand under these infested trees and literally get, it feels like a light rain that's coming down on you, that this is, you know, their insects are up there, they're pooping on you with this kind of sugary substance. And that's a huge reason why we call this a nuisance pest, especially for homeowners. So folks who have, you know, say a branch that overhangs their deck, if there happens to be spotted lanternfly there, you get honeydew raining down on your deck. So for people who want to be outside, maybe enjoy a glass of wine after work, really scratch that out. And then the other issue, if that's not enough, you know, the other issue is that we get this buildup of honeydew. And it starts to really coat the surfaces, so your patio furniture, your decks, your swimming pool, even your cars. And so when you're left with sugar water out in the environment, just to like, you know, say a sugary strawberry that you leave out in the environment, it's going to get moldy. So that same thing happens with this honeydew, where if we leave it out, it's going to start growing sooty mold. This is a really common mold. It's basically several different species of fungi that happen to just grow and feed on this sugar substance. And so it's common with other insects, you know, like aphids or scales that feed on plants. But the only difference here is it happens on a whole nother scale, where you just have masses of this honeydew and then this kind of thick sheet of black mold.
And, you know, I know I'll get asked this question, but does that harm the tree, sooty mold?
So the mold itself doesn't harm the tree because, you know, it's just feeding on that sugar substance. So if it's on, you know, the ground or on the bark surface, it's not expected to harm the tree. But it does change if it's on the leaf surface. And so it starts to coat that leaf surface, and basically what that does is block photosynthesis. So you end up with leaves that start to die back because they're, you know, they're blocked and they just start to wilt and die off. And so, again, when we talk about forest regeneration, we walk into an understory of a heavily infested forest with spotted lanternfly, and we start to actually see understory dieback of some of these younger saplings and underbrush. And we're still trying to figure out exactly what that means for long-term health of these forests and how far they actually penetrate these forests. But we're certainly worried about what this could mean for understory regeneration.
Mm. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with Ryan and John. John's out tonight. Tonight's topic is a spotted lanternfly with Penn State Extension's Heather Leach. Heather, we're going to take a break, but up next we're going to ask Heather more about what exactly are the different hosts and how we can monitor and more about the spotted lanternfly.
We'll be right back.
WIOX is supported by Margaretville Liquor Store with a wide variety of wines, including Rosé, Sauvignon, Albarino, and Vino Verde. Margaretville Liquor Store, Main Street in Margaretville, open 7 days a week, 845-586-4314. WIOX is supported by Town Tinker Tube Rental. For 40 years, offering whitewater tubing adventures on the Esopus Creek in Phoenicia, New York. Open 7 days a week. More information at towntinker.com.
You're just tuning in. You're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. And John's out tonight, but we are speaking with Heather Leach from Penn State about another invasive species, the spotted lanternfly. You believe this? So, Heather, hosts. That's what kind of got my attention when I first was reading about the spotted lanternfly, was the variety. It's a very diverse insect, unlike the emerald ash borer, who seems to like, you know, one tree, thank God. This thing likes a lot, no?
Yeah, exactly. And so with emerald ash borer, you've got it just right. The damage they do, you know, they kill trees within a couple of years. It's really drastic. When you look over at spotted lanternfly, you see a really diverse and broad host range. And so this makes it very problematic to control and actually understand its population levels. And so it's, you know, kind of what we consider a landscape-level pest. So it really will feed on practically anything. And I mentioned it doesn't tend to like conifers, but pretty much anything else is fair game. It does have a few favorites, and those include things like silver maple, red maple, an invasive tree called Tree of Heaven, and another invasive plant called Chinaberry, which tends to be more in the southern United States. But again, it'll feed on things like grass even. It'll feed on corn and soybeans if that's all it's got around. And it also tends to like a lot of those other invasive plants that we're battling in forests ourselves, things like ornamental bittersweet, multiflora rose, and some others just like that.
Now, I could be wrong, but, you know, bittersweet and tree of heaven and barberry. Did you say barberry or did you say multiflora? Multiflora, right?
Multiflora, yep.
A lot of those are from, I think, Asia. Is Atlanthus or Tree of Heaven from Asia as well? And why is it picking those? And you know, you think it would be more of a problem maybe on, well, I guess if there's no predators, it's not going to matter. But is it really targeting Atlanthus, huh?
That's the golden question. You know, a lot of us are very interested in that. So Tree of Heaven is in the native range where spotted lanternfly is from. And we see it, you know, researchers in China and in Korea as well. Observe spotted lanternfly feeding on Tree of Heaven in those areas. So we know that this is, you know, a host that they utilize in all areas that they are found. So we think it's important to them, and we definitely see strong preference for feeding if it's in that area, you know, of this kind of local area in the landscape. The thing is, you know, when spotted lanternfly first came here, some of the research suggested that Tree of Heaven might be a required host to complete its development. And when spotted lanternfly came here, that was kind of this underlying assumption that we had that, you know, they have to have Tree of Heaven at some point in their life cycle. And therefore, if we target Tree of Heaven for control, we can really eliminate the population and potentially eradicate it very quickly. So again, we're still working on the science there, and I can certainly go into more detail. But at this point, we're really not sure if it's required or not.
Yeah, not sure. I think sometimes it's easy just to blame Tree of Heaven because no one really likes it to begin with. So, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, it's, you know, let's get rid of it maybe. But I'm not so sure, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, the nice thing is, you know, spotted lanternfly doesn't typically kill trees, at least not to, not that we've seen so far. With the exception of Tree of Heaven, we have seen, you know, these trees can get very large, especially in Pennsylvania. There's some very large Tree of Heaven, and spotted lanternfly is capable of actually killing these trees. So it is nice to kind of see the decline of Tree of Heaven as a result of spotted lanternfly, but I have to say the benefits really stop there.
Yeah. It's a weedy tree, Tree of Heaven, right? I mean, it's hard to kill.
Exactly. It's very hard to kill, but it tends to like disturbed areas. So, you know, the sides of the roads, railways, things like that. Yeah. And it's hard to control. Like you said, it tends to grow. The female trees will produce seeds. The males won't. But both of them reproduce via clones. So oftentimes you won't just see one tree of heaven. You'll see several shooting up that are all, you know, basically the same plant, if you will.
Yeah, I only know of one where I live, and, you know, I need to talk to that person. But there's only one in my immediate area where I live that was planted. But, yeah, they can take off. So monitoring. How do you monitor for these things?
Yeah, so the best way that we have for monitoring them right now is kind of taking advantage of the behavior, especially that the nymphs do. So I mentioned that the nymphs really like to feed at the top of the canopy. We think that, especially since they're small, they might have more delicate mouth parts, that they need to feed on that kind of lush green growth, if you will. So oftentimes we'll see them crawling up the base of the tree, and either they jump down from the top or they get blown off by wind and are kind of constantly, you know, getting blown off and then come back down and then crawl back up the tree. And so they constantly are going upwards in trees. And so we take advantage of this behavior by using sticky bands wrapped around trees, which isn't exactly novel. People use it for gypsy moth and cankerworm and all sorts of other forestry pests as well. And it happens to also work very well for spotted lanternfly.
Oh, okay. Heather, it's kind of hard to describe visually what the spotted lanternfly looks like on the bark, but does it really cover the bark in totality in some cases?
In some cases, yes. So again, it depends on what species you're looking at, how many years you know, you've had spotted lanternfly in your area, and also what life stage they're in. The adults absolutely will cover the base of bark, in some cases to the point where, you know, it's literally a mass of hundreds covered on the bark. And these are large insects, especially as adults. They're at least an inch long. So, you know, you're dealing with something that's very large. It has a big growth factor. Even though they're pretty, when you start to get that many bugs, I think it starts to freak a lot of people out.
Now, it hasn't been seen in New York State alive, right? We just seen the dead carcasses of them. What does that mean?
Yeah, so it depends where you're talking about in New York. We actually have picked up a couple of live specimens in New York, but they're all what's kind of formally called regulatory incidents. So even if they're alive, there's basically a survey of that area that's done and good reason to believe that there's no additional living spotted lanternfly. So some of those examples can be, you know, somebody who came up, wanted to camp up in New York and came down from southeastern Pennsylvania and unknowingly brought some spotted lanternfly in. Other cases include, you know, where somebody is shipping something up. There happens to be a dead spotted lanternfly, maybe in plant material, and that gets shipped to, say, ornamental nursery up in New York somewhere. So all of these, indeed, actually are examples that have happened up in New York, and we've seen several counties kind of light up with indications that spotted lanternfly has been found, but we're not aware of any populations that exist in New York.
Man, I just don't believe that. What do you think? do you really think so? I mean,
you know, I don't. I hope they're not there, but I have to say, our detection ability when the population is low is really poor, and especially when we're in this life stage. I mean, I'm, you know, like I said, I'm in the middle of a forest, and I know that there's thousands here because I'm using those sticky bands, I'm using some other trapping techniques, but I can't see any from where I'm standing right now. And that's really, you know, it's just because they're nymphs, they're up in that canopy, and you don't really see that daily movement. I look at a trap that I have right here in front of me, and there's, you know, there's literally hundreds on this trap. And so I think that we really struggle with picking up low numbers of individuals.
Yeah, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say, but even foresters, New York State DEC foresters, were in and around the area in Saugerties and failed to see it. You know what I mean? The emerald ash borer when it first showed up.
Yeah, emerald ash borer is another one. It's these are, you know, even if they're larger insects, they're still they're sneaky. They're good at hiding, and they're you know, we're not trained to look at these things necessarily until they really become problematic. And so.
Yeah, and then, you know, I don't know how you feel about it, but I feel like it's easy to blame industry and nurseries on this on all these invasives, but you know, after the fact. The research I saw at an ISA conference for arborists was that the emerald ash borer they found was following every single interstate, which means they think it was not hitchhiking on water, but following cars, hitting the windshield, and how do you stop that? All cars. And once you start blaming cars, you're like, okay. I mean, you can blame a log, you know, that's being shipped, yep, or a stone pallet. That's an easy guy to target. But once you think it might be hitchhiking on the rear wheel of a car, well, there's a lot of cars out there.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And you know, I don't know if we'll have time later to talk about the permit system that we have in place to try to prevent spotted lanternfly from moving, and that's primarily targeted at businesses. And, you know, businesses are a little bit easier to regulate than, you know, average Joe driving up, taking his family camping. But certainly, you know, we've found spotted lanternfly nymphs in the air filter of cars, and those are all dead. I don't expect that to be a big problem, but again, the fact that they're getting into these little crevices in your vehicle, I totally agree with you. I think we have a lot of opportunity for spread, unfortunately.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest, and we're speaking with Heather Leach from Penn State Extension about the spotted lanternfly. Okay, so let's move along here. So what are some biocontrols and cultural controls that people or agencies are doing or can do?
Yeah, so with biological control, you know, I kind of mentioned this, there's not much. And this is, you know, because it's an invasive species and we're still trying to learn more about it. And, you know, again, it didn't bring over all of its greatest enemies from Asia. So we have a couple of predators that we've observed eating spotted lanternfly. These are things like praying mantises and spiders, so they're all very generalist predators. So it's fun to see them, you know, kind of helping us out here. But that's not something that we expect to really control the population, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like the cuckoo bird eating some emerald ash borer, you know? It's just not
Yeah, exactly like that, yeah. And then we have, you know, some parasitoids, actually one in particular that's endemic here, which basically means it's, you know, not necessarily, it's not native to here, but it was already brought here for control of gypsy moth. So that one happens to also be feeding on spotted lanternfly egg masses as well, so it parasitizes those egg masses. We're still trying to figure out exactly what's going on there, but really we're finding that it's occurring at very low levels. So there might be ways to boost that, but we're not, you know, we're not really there yet. And then the other exciting finding that's fairly recent in spotted lanternfly research is the discovery of two different fungal pathogens attacking spotted lanternfly. Now, one of these is really common. It's a fungal pathogen that attacks lots of other insects, and it's called Bovaria bassiana. This is a really well-studied fungal pathogen. It's actually available commercially to, you know, homeowners who want to use maybe organic or safer methods, because it's not, you know, it's not going to attack, say, birds or, you know, your dog or humans. It's not going to have toxicity issues there. So again, we're excited to find that, not completely surprised, but there might be ways that we can potentially, you know, use this as, say, drone, you know, overhead spraying with, you know, drones or helicopters on large scales to potentially reduce the population. So that's something that both Penn State and Cornell are partnering with this summer to really understand that research and see if it's possible to reduce spotted lanternfly populations on a large scale. And then the last one that I'll talk about is a new fungal pathogen that we know basically nothing about. So again, this is a collaboration between Penn State and Cornell University, and it's a fungal pathogen that Dr. Ann Hayek identified as Bacoa major. Typically, we see this attacking different beetle groups. It's one of those, you know, if you watch those nature documentaries, it's one of those crazy fungi that kind of messes with the mind of the insect. So once it attacks the insect, it kind of basically tells them, hey, crawl up on whatever you're on, crawl up. And when it does that with spotted lanternfly, they crawl up these trees, and then this fungal pathogen actually threads through the body into that tree of where it's, you know, crawled up, sewing them up high to that tree. And so the reason that it's doing that is so that when it sporulates and starts to infect other spotted lanternfly, it's able to infect a lot more since gravity is taking those spores down.
Amazing.
So, jeez. Yeah, it's very fun, definitely. We don't know a lot about it, and so we still have a lot of research to do there. So we're cautiously optimistic about that one.
It seems like when we ever have an insect outbreak, you know, in the past it would be gypsy moth or four-stent caterpillar, we see banding. So are we going to see banding in the future on trees?
Probably for a little while. You know, certainly me driving around southeastern Pennsylvania, and if you came down here to visit, you would see a lot of bands on trees, definitely in backyards and people trying to reduce populations. And so we know that, you know, it's not probably likely to control the whole population of spotted lanternfly. You know, when you think about the whole population out there and those, that population growth curve, you have to imagine there are millions, if not billions, of spotted lanternfly out there. But the reason that people band is because they think it might help, you know, in their backyard to reduce population pressure kind of on a local scale. So we are, you know, encouraging banding, but we also want to make sure that people are aware of the issues with banding. And so what I mean by that basically is bycatch and non-target capture. And primarily this is happening with other insects, so things like bees and butterflies. But potentially more concerning is when we're getting birds, bats, and squirrels. And so really, you know, when somebody's trying to help and trying to kill spotted lanternfly and you've realized you've just caught a bird, it's pretty heartbreaking and pretty discouraging. So there's a couple of ways that we can reduce that bycatch and make sure that, you know, we're not accidentally capturing and potentially killing these birds as well.
And you can put like a little cage around it maybe to try to reduce that?
Exactly, yep. You can put a cage around it. There's a couple of, you know, bands you can buy at the store which are kind of like inward facing, so you're not, you know, you don't have that sticky side out, so the birds aren't going to come in contact with it. Or you can use things like petroleum jelly, you know, Vaseline on some paper to try to capture them as well.
Now, how practical is scraping eggs?
Yeah, that's another good question. This is another practice that folks in the quarantine zone have done. You know, there's actually been some folks who have called, and they were trying to organize a wine event, you know, kind of a girlfriend's wine event to go out and scrape eggs. So they called it a sip and scrape. So they went out with some wine and they scraped eggs in their backyard. And so it was, again, kind of a fun way to educate people on spotted lanternfly. But spotted lanternfly will lay their eggs on practically anything. And actually, I think I can just remove practically. They really lay their eggs on anything. And if I, you know, if you, it sounds like you've done your homework, if you look at some of those pictures, they're pretty crazy. So they will lay at the tops of trees. And so, you know, we don't really recommend people go out and try to get ladders and scrape those eggs off. They'll also lay, you know, on the siding of your house. Some folks have reported that spotted lanternfly eggs laid on the inside of their grill on the cover. So they get creative. They're trying to hide. They're trying to protect their eggs. And so we think, you know, well, scraping eggs, again, may reduce local pressure. It's not practical on a large-scale population effort.
So, Heather, I've noticed that you've mentioned wine twice. And so what kind of wine do you drink?
Me? Oh, I drink all sorts of wine. I'm fond of reds mostly, but...
Yeah, all right. I just had to ask.
So... Yeah, no. And unfortunately, we see spotted lanternflies going after all varieties, so my reds are at risk, unfortunately.
Oh, man. So, yeah. Well, we're going to take a break, and up next, I'm going to ask you about chemicals. So we're going to get to the chemical controls. I'm really curious about it because I've heard a lot of yay and nays for it. But, yeah, we'll ask about that in just a few minutes. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest, and tonight's topic is spotted lanternfly with Penn State Extension's Heather Leach.
You see that mountain over there? Yeah, one of these days I'm gonna climb that mountain.
Like Grandma and Grandpa used to play. Then I'll float on down the river to Cajun Hideaway. Rip away like Tom Sawyer. Ride a raft with old Huck Finn. Take a nap like Rip Van Winkle. They stream.
that comes from the heart. Play something with lots of feeling, 'cause that's where music has to start. Oh, play me some mountain music like Grandma and Grandpa used to play. Then I'll float on down the river to Cajun Hideaway. Hey, hey.
With any sort of control, there's pros and cons, and in particular with chemical control, you know, this is a very highly, you know, talked about topic. It's very much in the media. So with any control, we have to be really careful. We have to know the risks, and we have to know how well it's actually going to work against the insect in the first place.
Yeah, and I see for, like, there's systemic insecticides, which is your neonics or your neonicotinoids, dinotefuran, and imidacloprid, I would imagine. Which are, yeah, you know, gaining a lot of controversy lately. We use them a lot at the Catskill Forest Association for killing, you know, the hemlock woolly adelgid and elongated hemlock scale. What do you think?
Yeah, so right now this is what the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, USDA, Virginia Department of Agriculture is using to control spotted lanternflies, the systemic dinotefuran. Okay. So this is, you know, a neonic, and it's highly talked about, especially when we think about, you know, talk about bees and what's safe for bees to be used. The other groups of insecticides that are commonly used against spotted lanternfly also include things like pyrethroids. Those can be very toxic to natural enemies and can cause decline there of you know, predators and parasitoid wasps. So often when we start to use these insecticides so frequently, we start to see the stir up of secondary pests, so things that wouldn't normally be a problem, like maybe tulip tree scale is an example of that, where last year we had a really bad outbreak down here of tulip tree scale, and it could be caused by spotted lanternfly or because of our actions in controlling spotted lanternfly. So we have to be really careful with, you know, our, especially our overuse of that. We have to consider, you know, insecticide resistance against, you know, if we keep using the same compound over and over and over again, that, you know, could eventually spell trouble. So again, you know, with any insecticide, you just have to, you know, be intelligent about it and make sure you know what you're spraying, you know what the risks are. But again, I really think it's the only thing that we have available right now to really effectively control this insect. Especially, you know, if I was sitting in New York and I happened to find spotted lanternfly, I would absolutely recommend the use of chemical control because we're very certain that that's going to kill that insect. And especially using this trap tree kind of design, which is using Tree of Heaven, again, a highly preferred host, and injecting dinotefuran into that tree. Now, one of the really nice advantages of doing this on Tree of Heaven is that not much native insects feed on Tree of Heaven, so we tend to see very little non-target effects. And, you know, what I mean by that is it's pretty much just spotted lanternfly feeding on it and spotted lanternfly being killed by these, you know, kind of toxic trap trees. So I see this as a really good way to kind of set up both monitoring and early control against spotted lanternfly.
Is that the preferred method, injection of dinotefuran?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different methods to get a systemic insecticide up into a tree, which I'm sure you know. We're still trying to figure out exactly what the best preferred method is, and it depends on the chemical, and we're finding that it also depends on the tree species. So we have a whole lot of research that's planned this summer to really kind of iron down on, you know, when do you apply, how do you apply. But right now, injection does seem to be one of the top methods, partly because you don't have to worry about the insecticide going anywhere else except for the tree. So if you have a low water or a high water table, you've got sandy soils, you really want to avoid doing things like a soil drench around the base of that tree for those roots to then take it up. Again, injection, you really don't have to worry about that. The other common way that folks are getting a systemic insecticide into the tree is using basal bark applications or trunk sprays. So again, you kind of coat the bottom part of that trunk, the tree, with the insecticide, and then it soaks into the bark and is able to get taken up into the tree. We're finding that that's also an effective way, and it in some cases can be cheaper than using tree injection. So it kind of depends on what tools you have available, basically, in your arsenal.
Yeah, and commercial applicators, pesticide applicators, have to check if it's legal in their state. New York State, I'm not sure if you can inject a dinotefuran. I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I'm not sure offhand.
I know you can't drench it.
I know we have gotten, yeah, with drench, yep, and probably trunk spray as well. And I know that there are a couple of label amendments that we've been trying to get from New York to kind of prepare the state for this bug, and so that could be one of them.
Okay, yeah, no kidding. So timing, what's the timing on the chemical? Do you guys know that yet, or is that still in the works?
Yeah, so again, it depends on which active ingredient you're using, what life stage you're treating, you know, you're going for, and then what tree you're treating. So when we're talking about Tree of Heaven, our recommended timing for that one is basically July through September, and it can maybe be pushed a little bit later, but the safest bet is July through September. So that's when that tree, you know, is actively growing, it's taking up that chemical compound, and it's when spotted lanternfly are most likely to feed on it. If you're using injection, that tends to last a little bit longer in the tree, so you might have longer control. If you're using a trunk spray, we have maybe about 2 months of control there. So we really want to target that for when we expect spotted lanternfly to be the most likely to feed on it, you know, within those 2 months, if that makes sense.
So if you're just tuning in, tonight's topic on From the Forest is spotted lanternfly with Penn State Extension's Heather Leach. Heather, we only got about 3 to 4 minutes. So is there anything you wanted to cover before the end of the show, recommendations for homeowners or something else?
Yeah, so the best thing I would say, especially again from a New York perspective, is that it's really important to look this bug up. So just Google spotted lanternfly and really know what each life stage looks like. You guys don't want this in your state, I can guarantee that. And so the more eyes that we have out there, the better prepared that you guys are for dealing with this. So getting those label amendments for insecticides, understanding what's going to be effective, is really the best advice I have moving forward. And again, you know, paying attention to Tree of Heaven. Like you said, if you've got one in your neighborhood, your neighbor's got one, you know, see if they're willing to remove it, see if they're at least aware of it and understand the potential risks there.
Is any of our counties bordering Pennsylvania in the Catskill Mountains? Is Sullivan County a bordering one?
No, not yet. So it's getting closer and closer, but not at this point. So it's we're not bordering yet.
Okay, good. So there's no, which so it's not bordering New York State yet, is what you're saying.
Right. Yep.
Okay, that's good. All right. Any other recommendations or ongoing research?
Well, I guess I would say stay tuned. It seems like, especially during the summer when we're getting the majority of our research done, a lot changes. We learn a lot within a very short time frame. And it's really difficult for us to keep these bugs alive, believe it or not, and also get the research done as fast as possible because they only have one generation a year. So again, things are changing, and if you find spotted lanternfly in your state, I would definitely encourage to look at the research that's going on at Cornell and also Penn State and make sure that, you know, you're aware of it and hopefully you report it as soon as you see it as well.
All right. Well, Heather, that's about all the time we have. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right, and we'll have to report back, see what's going on, and hopefully it stays on the west side of our border there and hopefully reduces there, too. I hope it doesn't come here.
Yep, I hope so. Thanks.
All right, take care, Heather. All right, bye. Yep, that was Heather Leach from Penn State Extension talking about another invasive species that's attacking our trees, and obviously we've been dealing with the emerald ash borer attacking and killing off the ash trees, and we have the hemlock woolly adelgid and elongate hemlock scale that are attacking in a big way hemlock trees, especially in Ulster and Sullivan counties, somewhat in Delaware County as well. But this spotted lanternfly is a nasty one. It doesn't usually kill trees. It's going to be kind of more of a nuisance, but it's not going to be good, especially if you're trying to grow fruit trees, and we all know how difficult it can be to grow fruit trees or grapes or whatnot. So that's all the time we have on From the Forest. Again, if you missed it, it was spotted lanternfly with Penn State Extension's Heather Leach, and you can look this one up pretty easily on the computer, and it's unmistakable. It doesn't have any lookalikes. Anyway, stay tuned and have a good night.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long-forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest.
You're listening to WIOX Roxbury Community Radio at 91.3 FM and WIOXradio.org.
WIOX is supported by the Catskill Mountain News, delivering news, features, arts, entertainment, and sports weekly since 1863. Available on newsstands by subscription or online at CatskillMountainNews.com. Catskill Mountain.